You're listening to America's Most Challenging Issue, where Baha'iTeachings.org interviews community builders across the nation who are inspired by the Baha'i vision of the oneness of humankind. Join us as we explore their work, bringing about racial unity and establishing a more just and equitable society. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. I have met some extraordinary individuals during my lifetime. Artists, scholars, committed public servants, and successful entrepreneurs who have encouraged my personal and professional development. Among that collective, perhaps no one has had as profound an impact on my life as our guest today, Miss Jamila Kennedy. In our nearly 30-year friendship, one that is more like a mother-son relationship, she has counseled me, encouraged me, defended, and corrected me. But more than that is she has given me the gift of the Baha'i faith, which she first shared with me while I was a 21-year-old student at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. A woman of remarkable insight and accomplishment, she has been a business owner, an actor, and a playwright, an educator, a servant of the poor, a community builder, and a principled proponent of justice. Her frenetic pace, one that would be difficult for someone half her age to match, centers on her life as a Baha'i and her commitment to advancing the Baha'i-inspired principle of the oneness of humankind. Not content to merely espouse the virtues of kindness, compassion, and friendliness, she consistently models these heavenly qualities as she greets the stranger, comforts the sorrowful, and encourages the downcast. In a society that increasingly seems incapable of living the values of its creed, she is a powerful example of someone striving to realize an integrated life, one that reflects the ideals of her beloved faith. Jamila Kennedy, welcome to America's Most Challenging Issue. You know, I'm so happy to have you here because it gives me an opportunity to really dig into some questions that I've kind of always wanted to ask you, but for whatever reason, never have. It seems going from place to place and it just never crossed my mind. And of all the qualities that I admire about you, and there are many, one thing that has always impressed me is your ability to always see the good in others. Now, in the Baha'i writings, they say that we are to look upon our neighbor with a bright and friendly face, and that we must focus on the positive qualities of an individual and not highlight their deficiencies. Now, some of us do that more effectively than others, right? But you have always been consistent, as far as I can tell, in doing that. I've seen it on display time and time again. And I wanted to know where that comes from for you, what the source of that is.
Well, I think the source of it, I would say my parents. My parents, they didn't know about the Baha'i faith. But as I reflect, they really prepared me for the faith because a lot of the principles they taught us are principles that are principles of the faith. To love each person that crosses your path with the utmost of passion. Respect everyone. Never make fun of anyone, but greet them with uplifting joy. So I think I was blessed. God was so gracious that he put us, my sister and I, in a family that we're living these principles. In fact, later when we became Baha'is, my dad said, wow, wish I'd known that when I was younger. He said, I think I could be a part of something like that. Mm. But I'm too old to change now. But he recognized that these were qualities that he lived by.
So it sounds like it was, so what you're saying essentially is that it was seeded through your parents. By your parents, and then it was nurtured even more in the context of the Baha'i faith.
Exactly. Mm. It was nurtured, and when I was investigating, and they spoke these principles to me, I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that this is really true. Even eliminating racism, my parents were so adamant about that. that anytime there was a person from another culture, they would ask that person, did they mind coming over? They wanted their children to meet them and talk to them a little bit and tell about their culture. So, I mean, they were even to that degree. So, I'm just all I can say is I'm grateful and I thank God for the jewels. My mom had a third grade education and was a very successful woman. Mm-hmm. And my dad did get to go to college for a year. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm saying they weren't highly educated, but they were very well learned, and they learned how. Yeah, they learned how to.
That's wonderful. Yeah, that's so wonderful. It makes me think about, you know, we live in a society today which is so invested in what in the Baha'i faith is called the kingdom of names and titles and degrees. And it's a wonderful thing to be educated, to have an advanced degree. That's a beautiful thing. I've been blessed that I've been able to gain one myself, and it's a wonderful thing. I wouldn't change that. But we have a tendency in our culture to, in a certain kind of sense, automatically appoint people or revere people just for a position that they occupy or a degree that they've acquired. And, you know, it's so interesting to me because you're talking about your mom having this third grade education. And, you know, I come from a family where I was really the first one in my family to go to college and get a degree in my immediate family. And some of the most profound things I've heard some profound things from educated people, but I've also heard some very profound things from people who weren't formally educated. So wisdom is not definitely dependent on on how many years of school you got.
Exactly. And, you know, just to cap her story, she ended up being the organist for our church.
Wow. Wow.
She loved music so much. She was determined to learn how to play music.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's
Isn't
amazing. That wonderful?
Wow.
That's God's work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, this virtue of friendliness has a particular resonance in the Black community, where too often people have experienced, you know, kind of these sustained traumas and difficulties over generations. And I'm wondering if that is something, you know, as you're going through the community, and I've seen you interact with a number of different people, and I'm wondering, you know, as you're going through the community, the Black community, if this is something that you think about, how kindliness, friendliness can impact communities that are suffering from sustained trauma.
Mm-hmm. It is something that I think of, and I think that, first of all, in general, people need to hear something uplifting. Mm-hmm. People need to hear something that you see good about them. A lot of times, you know, people are carrying heavy loads. Mm-hmm. Many times you just never know. So yeah. I think that in this hectic world that we're in now, just to say something good is just, you know, helps a person, and it puts a smile on the face.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that that's just a little gem that we can give someone, and we never know how valuable that gem is, because we don't know what they're carrying.
Reminds me of that story of Abdu'l-Bahá, the son of Baha'u'lláh, the prophet founder of the faith, and where I think he was in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken. Or no, I think he was in Manhattan, in the Bowery section of Manhattan. And we're talking early 1900s. Group of boys, one amongst them was an African-American child, the only African-American amongst the group. And he noticed how deferential that child was to the white children that were there, and how he looked at this child, you know, Abdu'l-Bahá, with that wisdom, that transcendent wisdom that he had, noticed that this child needed an encouraging word, and everybody needed to hear that encouraging word. And what he said, what we have here is a black rose, and how that child's face just beamed, just lit up. So what you're saying just reminds me of that, the impact of words, you know?
Yeah, well, you know what's that? That's funny that you, because you reminded me that when I first became a Baha'i, I really fell in love with Abdu'l-Bahá. I mean, I just, you know, I just used to talk to him a lot, and I wanted to be like him so much in any way. So it was often that sometimes I would think about what would Abdu'l-Bahá do in this situation? And I was thinking one day, I was passing this gentleman, and I said, how are you doing today? And he said, what? I said, well, how are you doing today? I said, well, what could I do to make your life better? He said, ma'am, he said, just saying hello to me, recognizing me. People usually turn their head the other way and they don't want to see me. So he said, you made a difference just by saying hello and how are you doing? And so it just sent chills all over me because that's something that I think I got from Abdul Baha, to just feel people and see them in circumstances and just try to uplift them. And that guy taught me so much. And it really blew me away how overwhelmed he was that I just asked him, how are you doing today?
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? You know, it's interesting. What you're saying, I think, links this this notion of friendliness to this other virtue, which is so important in the context of the Baha'i faith, and indeed in all the great religions, but particularly stressed in the context of the Baha'i faith, and that's this whole idea of service, right? And, one of the things that has always impressed me about your character is this just consistent readiness to be of service to others. And we know that within the context of the Baha'i faith, the station of servitude is considered to be the apex of human achievement, right? It's not how much money you have. It's not what station you occupy, how successful you are, how well known you are. That's not it. And this is the antithesis of the me-centered quest for fame and recognition that is at the heart of so much of society's present focus. And I wanted to know how you developed your commitment to a life of service. How did that, what was the genesis of that for you? Where did that come from for you?
Well, I have to go back to my years at home with my parents. And coming home from school, we lived in the city, in the urban community. And coming home from school, when I would, my sister and I would get to our house, well, there was nothing for three or four people to be sitting on the steps eating. And, you're passing by, excuse me, how are you doing today? How's your meal? And just my mom would have stuff ready, and people knew what house to go to. And so that, was such an example that it made an impressed on, an impression on my mind that is a kind and good thing to do. And because my mom used to do it, every day you'd, see different folks sitting on the steps, eating a well-balanced meal. I think that's where I started getting that from. And my parents, too. My dad, he worked for the grocery business for Kroger. And he would always, at that time, the stores would give away the food, instead of throwing it away. He'd bring tons of stuff, boxes and boxes of food for us to give to the neighbors and to neighboring communities around, just go around unloading this food to people who had large families.
It sounds like such a different time than when we are today. I mean, it's first of all, the grocery stores throw out the food now, right? The restaurants throw out the food. And we think of all the waste that just gets, just discarded, all the stuff that could feed, the hungry. And it sounds like that was such a different time, and your parents really had a heart for helping those who were less fortunate than themselves. And you saw that, and I imagine that is probably part of the reason why you connected so much with Abdul Baha, whose station is the station of certitude, you must have maybe, do you think you recognized something in Abdul Baha that seemed very familiar to you?
I think so. I think he was somebody that if he were around with my parents, they probably all know, they'd know each other, they'd hang out.
Wow. Well, they would make a striking partnership, him in his long robe, his fez, and them in their dress of the time. They would definitely stand out, that's for sure.
Because they do, they followed him a lot. Like I said, they always, when they met people from other countries, they always called them over, come here, come here. Mm-hmm. So if they, I'm almost positive, they probably would have done the same, gone up to him and talked to him and asked.
Now, you've been a Baha'i for many years, Ms. C, and I know that you had a rich and varied spiritual journey prior to your embrace of Baha'u'llah's revelation. And I'm wondering, as a Black woman, What is the unique response to the legacy of racism in America that this particular faith, the Baha'i faith, offers to humanity?
The thing that it offers to me is the oneness of humanity, stressing the oneness that we're one family.
Yeah.
That all the religions are one, and they all agree. Because in my spiritual journey, that was my issue with the religions, being a Catholic, starting off growing up a Catholic, and, you know, later going to traditional Christian churches. After that, going, moving forward to thinking about, at one time, going to the convent and thinking I was going to be a nun. And, you know, just I was attracted to spirituality, but I could see the racism that existed, and that became a real issue, and the disunity, because as soon as you start studying a certain religion, I would hear them say, now, so-and-so, if they're not this religion, they won't go to heaven, so you need to pray for them. If they're not Catholic, they will not go to heaven, and those kinds of messages, those messages is not something I think God would say. It never sounded God-like to me. And in my journey, even in the convent, there was a little racism there, but some of the people were so friendly and lovely, but just some of the principles were definitely racist, very racist issues. In Islam, I later became a Muslim, and in Islam, I ran into this disunity again, being told don't associate with women that didn't wear Islamic garb. And so I just kept moving and moving, and my buzzword seemed to be the word unity, because that just seemed like what God would do. So every time I would get to that situation of disunity, then I knew I had to go. I had to keep searching. I had to continue my search. And so that's amazing, but that is exactly what took me to the faith when I heard the word unity.
That's so wonderful. I mean, you know, your story, what you're sharing to me, reminds me of the whole, you know, the principle, one of the core principles of the faith being independent investigation of truth. And how for you, and everybody's journey is different, right? But it's the respect and the honoring of a person's journey and not being attached to where they land, allowing them, encouraging them to seek the truth, that God has endowed us all with the ability to recognize the truth and to discern also what is false. And it's, you know, it sounds like from what you're sharing that your word was unity, was this kind of integration of difference, you know? And you listening to that inside of yourself, and then also coming in contact with the faith, which said that what you're doing, trusting your intuition, your reason, your reflection is actually a core principle of the Baha'i faith. This is what Baha'u'llah emphasizes. It is a spiritual law. So in many ways, your practice, your journey towards coming to the Baha'i faith was really a fulfillment of that core principle in a way. That's so interesting.
And that later when I found out, I was so grateful.
Yeah.
Because you can hear people talk about these different religions, and you'd hear some very negative talk sometimes. And I was just grateful that to have been a part and to love each one of them until I ran into that stumbling block of, okay, no, but you can't, don't hang with that person. But, you know, when I was involved in Islam, I love the life of Islam. I love the community. I just love Muhammad. And I just, you know, I really loved each one of the religions that I was involved in. So I feel good that now I can talk to other people, but I have a positive story to tell that I loved each one of them. I gained and I grew. I love the sisterhood and the community coming together, cooking together. And, you know, so it's just each one had such beautiful gems that just brighten your life.
It's so interesting because as a Baha'i, of course, the notion of betrayal of your faith is something that doesn't exist. The Baha'i faith, from the Baha'i context, is viewed as being the fulfillment of the previous revelations. So an embrace of the faith is an embrace of all the other revelations. And I always found that was one of the most interesting things to me when I was investigating faith. I was like, wow. So, you know, it's like, wait a minute. Muhammad is a messenger of God. Yes. Christ is a messenger. Yes. You know, Krishna, not only them, Krishna, Zoroastra, Buddha, the traditional African religions, the traditional Native American religions. So.
And it was like, go God. That's the way it's supposed to be. It is so liberating because I remember when I was visiting this home where I was going for firesides, and I said, well, I'm telling you, if you tell me that I'm not supposed to love Muhammad, or if you tell me I'm not supposed to love Jesus Christ, and if I say, oh, Jesus, help me, you all get all upset. I said, I'm not in the right place. I said, you know, those expressions are expressions I've kind of grown up with and heard my mom say. And and so I just wanted to know if I could bring all my troops with me that I love and call on them. And so I was so excited when they, you know, when they said, oh, yeah, we believe in all of them. So
that's wonderful. And I think the other thing in that is interesting is, you know, so much of fear is associated with religious teaching nowadays. That's the way that people are controlled. That's the way that they're kind of held in check, and their own and that whole idea of independent investigation of truth is kind of kept at bay. Because that is something that, you know, you have to believe this way. So belief is predicated on fear. And it's just really liberating to know that, you know, Baha'u'llah, so that teaching is such an act of love and such an act of freedom for us. Like, no, you have a responsibility to investigate truth for yourself and then make a decision.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know when I was working at, I worked at Spelman for few years, and students would tell me about, oh, I found a new church, I'm so excited.
This is Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, right? Women's College.
Right, Spelman College and Women's College, yes, I'm sorry. So, and I remember the value of telling the students, investigate the history of that faith and see how it was started to determine if that's the journey that's for you. And a number of times students did that and came back and said, wow, I never thought about that. It's not what I thought it was, or it was greater than I thought it was. But it's just important. Your spiritual life is the most important thing that you can do for yourself, is to strive to learn how to get closer to God. That's the greatest thing you can do in your life. That's the greatest thing you can do.
Well, you know, that's a perfect segue into my next question, which really is, you know, gets into one of the key methods that you've employed in your ongoing spiritual work of community building. And, you know, it's been your biweekly devotional gatherings that you host every other Friday. And I've been to several of these, and they are amazing. You know, this initiative is one of the core activities the Baha'i World community has been engaged in to help strengthen our communities, right? And a unique feature of yours is the diversity that's represented. I mean, you know, you live in a predominantly African-American community, and your devotional gatherings reflect that demographic. But you also attract a substantial number of other cultural groups who attend and contribute their perspective and energy to the dynamic force of the meetings. And, you know, our faith, the core principle of the Baha'i faith is the oneness of mankind. And your devotional gatherings really seem to reflect that. And I wanted to know, why are these devotional gatherings important in helping to develop communities?
Oh, wow. I tell you, they give people an opportunity to bring their whole self with them and to talk about their hearts and their spiritual desires and dreams and aspirations. So it really gives people a chance to share. And the thing that I really love about it more than anything, too, is intergenerational. And so we have, you know, students from the colleges, because I live very close to the Atlanta University Center. And in fact, this devotional was started by, there were five students who wanted to take a book one, and they finished the book one, and they were like, oh my God, what are we going to do with our time now? Our book one's over. And I started telling them about the other book series, and they said, well, that's too much like studying, and we're in school already. So I said, well, okay, if we don't do the another book.
This was book one, The Life of the Spirit, right?
Right. Yes. Okay. The Reflections of the Life of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. Right. And they loved that book, talking about how to be spiritual beings, because, you know, can you believe that I was shocked, actually, when one of the students said, you know, people keep saying that we're spiritual beings, but who's going to teach us how to be spiritual beings? We are being taught how to be physical beings and deal with material things. And someone needs to teach us. So that's why we took the Reflections of the Life of the Spirit. And we really enjoyed that. So the students decided that they wanted to stay together and that we would start a devotional. And everybody had just kind of gotten into meditation in that group. So they said, well, why don't we have a devotional gathering that has a meditation as part of it? So it really came out of it. I love to say it came out of the call from the community to do it that way. So and I said, why not? You know, nothing in the Baha'i faith says we can't do that. So that's how we actually started having we started off with a 15-minute silent meditation. And people kind of outgrew that quickly. And before you know it, we were at 30-minute silent meditation. And the silent meditation, the focus is on the oneness of humanity and to help bring about the spirit of oneness in our neighborhood, to focus on raising the standard of oneness in our neighbor, in our community. And it is really growing. It started off with, we usually had a standard of about seven people. There were regulars. And as of the last devotion we had last Friday, I think we had 28 people. And the largest group we've ever had was 32 people.
If anybody knew, your home is beautifully appointed and clean and well ordered, but it's not palatial. So to squeeze 32 people.
it was funny because they were sitting up the steps. It's a two-bedroom townhouse. Right. And so they were going, sitting up the steps up to the bedroom. But it was amazing. I mean, the love and the spirit and the joy. And then usually we'll infuse it with some arts because we study a passage what Baha'u'llah says about meditation. And he's telling us that we are asking questions and we're getting our answers when we're meditating. And he also says that it activates the arts and sciences. Well, I always love to have arts in anything that's going on because before I moved into that house, I used to have firesides and that was full of arts and discussion. So anyway, arts to activate the soul. So now we share some art. Sometimes people have an inspiration that comes to them during their meditation, and because there are some poets that come regularly, and so they get an inspiration and they'll share a poem or a song or you know. So we just make it all fun and enjoying the. As one of the students said one day, they said, "Wow, this is just like one big old happy family, just having family night together."
You know, I've known you. I met you in the capacity of your engagement with students. And of course, I was a student then. And, you know, I think we should tell a little bit about that story because I think it's important. But we're talking some 25 years ago. We've known each other going on 30 years now. And, you know, at the time, I was a student at Morehouse and was seeing this really talented, intelligent, and just beautiful sister, named Batima Tanae Cochran, who has crossed over to the real reward on the other side, and is she introduced us, and as soon as we met, there was like this sense of knowing. You know, I mean, I felt a deep sense of knowing, like we had known each other for a very long time. And then the friendship, of course, I learned about the faith through you. And then the friendship just blossomed from there. But I think our connection for me is this deep, resonant spiritual connection that really is a soul, operates at the level of the soul.
And when you think about it, it is, it's really God's, it shows us God's love for us. Because that young lady did not know she was going to be passing away.
Yeah.
But she brought you to my office and said, I have a dear friend, and I think a lot of him. And he thinks he wants to be a priest. And she said, I think he would make a great Baha'i. And she said, I hope that you can talk to him about that. That's like an angel.
Yeah.
Because she later passed away shortly after that, not too long.
Yeah.
So it's such a beautiful story of love. I mean, that was sincere love. And it's a beautiful story of how God works through us. She said, I'll probably never get to be a Baha'i. But he should be one.
Well, you know, we are just about out of time. But before you go, I wanted to ask you about hope. You know, the issue of racism is stubbornly resilient, right? And the work of eradicating it is often difficult and it can be discouraging. And I wanted to know, where do you look for hope? And what reserves of strength do you draw on to keep going, to keep doing the work?
I guess I have to admit I am getting older. I'm talking like an old lady now. but the thing is, you know, I have to go back to my ancestors. I have to go back to my mom and dad. And the reason, too, that I have to give them the honor, because they did not birth my sister and I. They raised us, but they did not birth us. And but the thing about them, they gave us examples. Racism was livid at that time. I mean, when we were growing up, it was really, it's still big. And but they had white friends that would come to the home that loved them, and they loved them a lot. They were friends. My dad, as I mentioned, he was a stockman at Kroger store, but he also was hired to do the graphic arts design. Because his white friend that he grew up with in Topeka, Kansas, he got the job at Kroger, and he told them he would come if he could bring his friend, his black friend. And they hired my dad. He had to be a stockman during the day because they would not let a black man be a graphic artist. So he had to stock by day and do the advertisement by night. And so I was watching him work hours, working all day, coming in, doing the signs, having to ship them out to the whole Southeast region. But what I did see is the love between he and his friend. And his friend loved him enough to put himself on the line as a requirement. I'll come if. So that's the hope I have, Masood. I know there are others like him. I know he used to come over and just cry if any injustice was happening to my dad. He would cry with me. He would cry and hug him. And so I saw such a love between them. I know what it looks like when the world starts loving one another. I know what it looks like. And I hold on to that visual that I've experienced.
Wow. Well, you know, I feel really blessed and really happy to have been able to have you spend a little bit of time with us on America's Most Challenging Issue. It's always such a joy for me to have the elders on the show who are really the keepers of a lot of the accumulated wisdom over the years and the lessons. And I'm also feel really blessed to have known you for going on 3 decades, to have watched you, to have seen your example. And because of the wonderful example that you've set, have strived over the years myself to integrate some of the lessons that you've taught me. So I want to thank you for all of those things and for sharing the Baha'i Faith with me, which changed my life and continues to change my life.
You know, but I just want to say, Masood, yeah, I was saying this learning, and I was telling some young people the other night that we have to keep sharing with each other. Mm. I can share something, and I'm not saying wisdom is not just handed over. All old people are wise. That's not true. Mm-hmm. You ever heard of an old fool?
I've known some. I'm not naming names, but I have known some.
I'm just kind of joking, but this whole thing about this innate wisdom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't even get to the truth until you're almost at the end. Like, oh my goodness. Yeah. And so, and a lot of times it's from young people having conversations with them and having your ears open to listen and learn.
Yeah.
And then you may say, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Wow, this is a different perspective to look at it. I can clean that up like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It takes all of us. It really does.
Yeah. And I think with you, that has always been impressive for me, though, is this ability to always balance these two realities, being a teacher and also being a student. And you've always exemplified to me the capacity, first of all, to impart a learning or a knowing that you've acquired over the years with someone who you feel like would benefit from that. You know, gem of truth, and then also a capacity to learn, to be open to learning and integrating new knowledge. And, you know, if ever we needed that example, we need it now. So I want to thank you for that. You've been listening to America's Most Challenging Issue. I'm your host, Masood Olofani. And remember, that which the Lord hath ordained as the sovereign remedy and mightiest instrument for the healing of all the world is the union of all its peoples in one universal cause, one common faith. This can in no wise be achieved except through the power of a skilled and all-powerful and inspired physician. This verily is the truth, and all else, naught but error. From the Baha'i Writings. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.